do it or does he don't? Or do we work on it? You say work to me and you've lost me. You know, I'm lazy at best. Then it says, step 7 says, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings in the prayer. Finally, what Jack told me made sense one day. It just clicked. And it's this. When we ask, if I'm going to ask you, would you pick up this water for me and remove it off the table? Does that mean you're going to sit there in that chair and work on it? No. It means BJ is going to come. She's going to take this cup of water and she's going to remove it and sit down with it. And it's gone. If I ask God, if I'm entirely ready for him to take this cup of water, he'll take it. And it's gone. What I finally found out from Jack is that I know where the cup is. And I can go get it anytime I want to. The problem is, if I go get that cup from BJ, it doesn't belong to me anymore. And if I drink that water, it's going to make me sick. My stomach's going to hurt because it doesn't belong to me. That made so much sense to me. Character defects are something that I need to help me survive. Example, my lying. I'm a liar. It hurt me so bad that I quit it. I asked God, please take this lying away from me. And he did. He removed the character defect of lying from me. It no longer belongs to me. Now, I don't do it anymore unless I absolutely have to. I might be in the middle of a sentence and I'm realizing this is not quite true. And so I'm going to confuse you for a minute and back up and start back in the truth. I know it. Because the minute I start lying, my stomach hurts, my throat starts hurting. It don't belong to me. But I have the choice. I have a choice to lie today if I want to. But see, I don't need that need. I don't have the need. He said, why don't you pray this? God, please remove the need of this character defect in my life. So that I'm standing here and I'm telling you, I'm a high school dropout. I don't lie about that anymore. Somehow that just killed me because everybody in the world graduated from high school but me. I'm a high school dropout. I used to lie about that like a rock. I used to lie about my daughter that her father and I were married and he da-da-da-da. We were shacked up. I'm standing here telling you who I am and most of you don't really care. Doesn't make any difference. But it was my lie. I lied about it. The only defense I have now is God. I can't defend myself. If I'm wrong, I can't defend myself. If I'm right, I don't need to. I don't have to explain y'all to me. Me to y'all. I don't have to. This is who I am. God loves me good and bad. He's accepted me good and bad. And that's the defense that I need is my God, my prayer. When you drive me crazy and I won't lie to you, I don't have to lie to you. I can talk to God silently while I'm sitting there grinning at you. God, she's a real witch. That's the only defense I have is just talk to God. I don't have to lie about nothing unless I choose to. And that is such a freedom. It is such a freedom. It's a character defect. It's over here. I can use again if I choose to, but I just don't choose today because it makes my stomach hurt. God does and can remove them when we ask him to. I have to work on it. If I have to work on it, I'm going to set a screw with it forever. I worked on stuff before I got here. Explained to everybody. Okay, one of the things that I discovered about taking the 6th and 7th step is I take it and I get up off my knees after I've taken it. And I act as if it's really been done. I act that way. Period. I act like I'm not a liar anymore. I'll tell you the truth. That's how I act like I'm not a liar. I'll tell you the truth. Period. And sometime down the road, all of a sudden, I'm in a meeting, I'm hearing somebody talk, and I'm thinking, I don't do that anymore. I don't feel that anymore. The character defect has been removed, and I don't know when it happened. I prayed about it, and I thought as soon as I got up, there'd be a bolt of lightning, and the room would kind of vibrate, but it doesn't happen that way for me. I just get up and act as if I can't lie anymore, so I tell you the truth. And what happens is I find myself later on, I don't do that anymore. Isn't that great? There's a story my sponsor tells about the umbrella. God's grace. God's grace removes character defects from me. His grace keeps me in okayness. His umbrella is over Saturday. The grace of God is over Saturday for me. Now, if I step out of Saturday and try to go into tomorrow, I'm not going to feel good. The character defects are over there that don't belong to me. Fear, expectations, depressions, what ifs. And I just don't belong over there. So I step back under God's grace. I step back into Saturday and I'm okay. Now, if I step back out of this and go over there to last Thursday when he was mean to me, or 10 years ago when I told him this would happen, I feel real bad. I'm in a character defect of blaming or complaining or depression or something. It doesn't belong to me. So I step back into Saturday under God's grace, under this umbrella. And I am absolutely so fine today. Aren't y'all all just all fine today? Amen. Just fine. Because we're Saturday. We're here. We're under God's grace. And that's where I want to be. That's where it makes me feel good, is to be here with you, feeling okay. I don't want to go into yesterday or tomorrow. I think that's it until we have an experience with making amends. Now, I want to tell y'all something. Up to this point, it's been easy and fun and delightful for me. The next session that we're going to go through is going to be hard for me. And I'm going to need for y'all to get me prayed up. Okay? I believe in being prayed up because I can't do this by myself. Do y'all hear me? I can't do this. And I don't want to stand up here and bawl and squall and you can't hear me and my mascara run. And I'd like to present it in a halfway decent manner. But it's painful right now. So I really need for y'all to pray up for me before we come back together. Okay? Next time, by God, Shirley, you be on time.
This is the end of session 3, the start of session 4.
Thanks. Hi, everybody. I'm Vinoy Shaw, and I'm a member of Al-Anon.
Hi.
Well, I swam around the hot tub, hot springs. I feel great. I sure want to take a nap, but there's just not enough time, is there, when you go out there and play in that water. And it was wonderful. Thank you for bringing me back. That was really special. Well, when you get... They say when you have an inventory, you have your list made for the amends. A lot of people say that. We did a little different because the 8th step says what we're going to talk about this hour, 8th and 9th. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And 9 is made direct amends to whoever possible except when to do so would injure them or others. When I first started off, the thing that she asked me to do was relationships. And I read to you out of this 8th step. And as you can see thus far where I kind of come from and what I've done up to this point. And it says step 8 is concerned with personal relationships. First, we took a look backward, which I've done, and tried to discover where I was at fault, which I tried to do. Next, we make a vigorous attempt to repair the damage we have done. And third, having thus cleaned away the debris of our past, we consider how, with our newfound knowledge of ourselves, we may develop the very best possible relationship with every person that we know. So in my list, on the inventory, it was destroyed because mine was pretty yucky, my first one. And so we destroyed that. So when we got to the 8th step, it says, made a list. I think it's real important for me to remember that. This says, made a list. This doesn't say, made a list and ran out. All this said was, made a list. for the people that we had harmed and became willing to make amends with them all. Doesn't say go do it. Thank goodness. All I had to do was make the list. All I had to do is be willing. Didn't say I had to. So it's like the fourth step. I'm afraid to write the fourth step because the fifth step comes after it. I don't get into the fifth step. I write an inventory, and then I see what to do with it. Same thing with this. I made a list. And, of course, it's my definition plus your definition or his definition or their definition. What does harm mean? What I think is harm, you may not think is harm. And vice versa. There was a man that said this. I listened to some tapes of his 12 step, and it was really good. And he said that this is how he was told to do it. Make a list of the people that you harm. Go to them and say, I know I've harmed you in this way, in that way, in this way, and will you forgive me? Then say to them, listen to this, say to them, tell me how I have harmed you and what you would like for me to do to take care of it. Can you imagine such a thing? What have I done to harm you, and can you tell me what to do that will fix it? That's a big deal, isn't it? That's really willing to go to any length. That's a big thing. And I know, since I've heard that, which is recently, there's probably some people that I probably need to go back to. And we'll have to make another list one of these days to take a look at that. Because I did what I thought I harmed and took care of that. Who did I harm? Who's on my list? My parents. My parents were on that list. They were very hard-working people. In my family was my parents, my oldest brother, the one who broke his neck. He almost died over and over and over through the years. It was just a long, dreary, tedious thing for my parents. Today, he's almost died several times, not from the accident. Today, he's almost dying from the stuff he's putting in his nose and in his throat and in his veins. He's had both legs amputated through the years. He's about this long. He weighs about 80 pounds. He's the most pitiful looking thing. And he's just hooked on all kinds of stuff. Next was my brother, who was kind of the star of the family. He kind of took care of everybody. When I was a kid, he took care of me. When I was a teenager, he was out working, and he did things for me. He gave me his car. He gave me my spending money. He pretty well told me where I could go and where I couldn't go. He was my hero. He kept people away from me that shouldn't be around me for a long time, and a really neat guy. I have a younger brother who's just mama's pet. Yeah. You know, he ain't never done nothing wrong, missed nothing. He was the last kid at home, and by that time they had recuperated and things were going well, and they bought him a brand new car. And by me, no brand new car. He's the only one in our bunch that went to college, graduated. He's very athletic. He's in the Hall of Fame at Texas Tech for his basketball abilities. He married this cute little girl, and they got 2.4 kids, and he's got a Ranger, and you know. He's just coming right on up in his company. You know, he ain't done a damn thing wrong yet. And it just makes me sick. And I just love him better than anything. He's an okay guy. Now, my parents, in my madness, told me when the murder happened. My mother said to me, we don't want you coming over here anymore. We don't want anybody to see you coming in and out of the house. She said to me, if anybody asks if you're our daughter, please don't tell them that you are. And I said, okay, Mama, you know, I understood that. My brother Jimmy, the second brother, he quit speaking to me because of all my antics. He, 28 years, didn't speak to me. We'd be around the family, and I wasn't present. I mean, he'd walk past me. My hero wouldn't have anything to do with me. And it was probably one of the most painful things in my family, because he was my hero. I just loved him a lot. When I divorced my practicing alcoholic, I had two kids. I was in this program. I was in this fellowship. Being a high school dropout, some of the things that I was taught to do was follow directions, and I got directions from three different, totally complete different people out of three different worlds. They weren't even in Al-Anon, that suggested that I might become a nurse. Now, I had never thought about being a nurse. I never had a dream of being a nurse. I never played with Band-Aids when I was a kid. I get car sick, and I just couldn't imagine bedpans. It's just... But somehow or another, I got in nursing school. It's just a miracle story all on its own. People that loved me helped me get through school. I worked at this same drugstore for 10 years because I didn't know what else to do. And they helped me get through school. Some people in the program helped me get to school. One of the men in the program named Bedford helped me get on Texas Rehab and paid my way through the school. A lady helped me get on welfare, pretty lady, lovely lady. Put me on welfare, boy, and that was a trip. And people in my group did things for me, and they helped me. They picked me up, and they gathered me, and they took me to nursing school. By the time I got in nursing school, I pretty well worked these steps. I was told how to do these steps by my sponsor. It says that when we make that list, we put our own emotions aside. We just make them. When I do make the list, I take it to my sponsor. I don't go out on my own to make amends. I did once before I told her, before she kind of got on me. There was a lady in my group I didn't like. She was just weird. And one time she did something nice and I liked her. So I went up to her one night and I said, I didn't used to like you, but I like you now. I was making amends. I just thought, that was what you're supposed to do, so I made an amend to her. And then I was so proud. And I went and told my sponsor that I made amends, and I told her what I did. And she, all the color kind of drained out of her face. And so she sat me down and explained to me, number one, that I hadn't made a list, and number two, that I didn't make amends without checking out with her, and number three, that I didn't make amends, I just dumped my garbage on this lady. That I had felt bad about my own feelings toward her, which she didn't know, and went and informed her about it. And as I've talked to somebody today, what goes around comes around, always is full circle for me. And several years later, I was in the group, and this girl came up. She says, I need to make amends to you. I thought, that's okay. And I drive home in the car, and I thought, well, I wonder what I did to her. I didn't do anything to her. What did I do? Wonder what I said. And I spent, the next couple of days pissed off at her because she didn't tell me what I did. She just didn't like me, now she liked me. And my mind just tripped off. So it's dangerous to do those things. So I made the list of these people in my life, and I took them to my sponsor, and she and I used some good judgment on it. What to do and what not to do. Some of these amends were a direct amend. It was going to someone and making an amend. Now, I don't know if you're the Al-Anon of my type, but I've already told you to say I'm sorry. Just, it just chokes me. She said to me, these that I go and make amends to, I'm careful about the way I say it. Because I'm just really subject to, and I just laugh at my husband, he is always doing this, but I'm subject to say, well, I'm really sorry that I hurt your feelings. However, I just really wouldn't have done that if you hadn't have. She said, we don't do that. She said, this is the way you go and make a direct amend. And this is what you say. For my part in our disagreement, I was wrong. Will you please forgive me? Then I'm done with it. And it's up to the other person what they do with it. Well, that's some tough stuff. It is for me. change that. Some were letters. I had a lot of write a letter with, she and I decided to write a letter to my brother Jimmy, because he'd moved down to South Texas, and he wouldn't allow me in his home. He had quit even letting my children in his home, and he didn't hardly speak to my kids. So I knew there was no way, he was unapproachable. So she said to write him a letter. And so I did. I wrote him a letter, and I told him that I was in this program and what my life was about, and that I had humiliated my family, and I knew it, and him, and I had broken his trust, and that I was really wrong, and I was trying to live a different lifestyle, and I hoped that he would please forgive me. And I mailed it. And of course, I never heard a thing, nothing. My mother said to me one time, she said, I'm going to say this to you, and I'm not going to say anything else, but your brother got your letter. I said, thanks. And that was all that was ever said. And he never spoke to me, and it was never any different. But I had done what I needed to do. In my head was, because I heard a little drift from down that way, from down South Texas, that he might be drinking. And if he was, then I probably knew what it was that was going on with him. And I resigned myself to this. I didn't accept it. I resigned myself to this. That there would come a time when it would be okay. Eventually, I had it in my head, everybody's going to get sober. And eventually, everybody's going to work the steps. And eventually, it's all going to be okay. But he was the one in my life that didn't do that. I made amends to my brothers, and it was accepted. And it was my other two brothers accepted. And it was done okay. I made amends to my children and to my parents. I graduated from nursing school, and I was asked by my class to give the class response, which is a pretty neat deal. It's a pretty big deal. And I was giving the class response, and I was looking out in the audience, and it was in a huge church, and there was probably 600 people there. It was wonderful. And I looked over here, and here was all my AA family, just bunches of them, you know, just, it was really exciting. And I looked down in the middle of that bunch, and there was my mama and my daddy. They were sitting there. And I saw my daddy, and he was crying, and he was telling somebody, that's my daughter up there. They were telling people I was their daughter. They didn't do anything different. I had a different lifestyle. I had made amends to them, and I had changed. And what a neat deal it was. The results of amends sometimes just blow me away. You know, there's promises about the amends, and I'll read them a little bit, but the amends that I have made and what comes about them is that full circle stuff. This employer that helped me get through school, who helped me with financially. He had a sister that worked at the drugstore with me, and she was a real witch. I mean, smiley, know-it-all witch. And I didn't like her at all. And when I was first around the program, I remember hearing this in the meetings, and they said a lot back then. They said, if you don't like somebody, write a list of everything about them you don't like. Just put it down there. Born mentally, I was... She's a witch. She thought of know-it-all. She just tried to tell me what to do. She didn't know what to do. Just, I had this long list. And then they said, Randa said this. I'll never forget it. Then Randa said, when you get through, go back and put your name at the top. Well, that was kind of startling to me. You know, I thought, I was not like her. However, I put her on my list. She was on my list. Practically the first one on there, which is amazing to me because that was a nothing. The only thing I did was try to drag her over a counter one day, you know. And I still didn't like her. And she didn't like me. And she was one of the first ones on my... Now, I've got this family that I tore apart, but she's on my list. Isn't that amazing? So right after I made the list, guess who I saw? I hadn't seen her in 10 years. I hadn't seen her in 10, 12 years. Hadn't seen her. Nowhere. Didn't know where she was, still in Texas or Kingdom Come. And guess who I saw 2 or 3 days later? Stamps thing I ever saw in my life. I went to a shower, opened the door, walked in. She's the first person I saw. And for me, at that time, I made a great, huge amend. I said, well, hi, how are you? She said, fine, how are you? And I said, great, and passed right on by. And that's the best I could do. Now, this is what I know about amends. This is what I know about the God that I love and understand and try to be of service to. That there's full circles. He gave me another opportunity to make amends. And if I screwed it up the second time, I'm sure he would have gave me the third and the fourth and the fifth, because he loves me that much. A few years later, I ran into her again at the drugstore, her brother's drugstore, and I said, hi. She said, hi, let's have a cup of coffee. And I said, sure. It's like we're old friends or something. And we went, we sat down, and we started having a cup of coffee, and she said, but no, I've got cancer, and I'm dying. I said, well, I'll be damned. My daddy's got cancer, and he's dying. And she said, you know, it's just tough. My family, you know, they just won't accept this, and they won't let me talk to him. I said, well, I understand. I just can't talk to my daddy. And she said, I want to tell them so many things, and they won't listen. I said, I know. There's so many things I want to tell my daddy, and I can't. She said, tell me, and let me tell you. So I sat there and told her all the things I'd like to tell my daddy and couldn't. And she sat there and told me all the things she'd like to tell her family, her loved ones, and they wouldn't let her. And we cried together and we loved together. And because of that meeting, because of that amend was made between us, I was able to go back home and crawl in the middle of my daddy's bed and sit there and cry with him and say, Daddy, I'm going to miss you so bad. And I love you a lot. And it's going to be real hard when you die. And he said he knew it, and he loved me, and I was his favorite kid. And I'll carry that, you know, from now on. I stood by my daddy's bed for about a week and took care of him. And I wouldn't, you know, I just was the one that took care of him. And I did a really good job. And the guy who helped me get through school, I was able to take care of him when he died. The lady who put me on welfare, I was able to take care of her when she died. Sweet things, sweet things. There's a man named Bob White, who Marcy's husband that y'all know, that died of cancer, and I was able to go down there and sleep with Bob. I was able to take care of him. So these amends, they're so full circle. They're so amazing. I was able to tell my children I've done the best I could for you. I've helped you the best I know how. What a miracle. I've asked my daughter to forgive me, and she has. What a miracle. We're still working on that. What miracles. What miracles. When my brother married, he had two kids, Tanya and Butch, which I just love them both better than anything. And he married this weird lady. She's an alcoholic, you know. Our family is surrounded with it, so it makes it good sense of what's going on. Tanya, my little niece, I absolutely loved her better than anything in this world. She looks just like me. Just drive those people crazy. She acts a lot like me, and her mother would say to her with complete and total disdain, you're just like Vinoy. And it suited me and Tanya just fine because we just loved each other so much. Tanya's an alcoholic. On drugs pretty bad, real bad. Tanya had a child out of wedlock. And then she had another child out of wedlock. And my brother quit speaking to her. He tried to help her once, and then she wouldn't accept the help, and then that was the end of it. He just wouldn't speak to her. He just literally blocked her out of his life. He never laid eyes on his grandchildren. Two sweet, precious little girls. When my daughter had a year of sobriety, we went back to Lubbock for her. My stepdaughter, my husband and I went back to Lubbock to be with her. She asked me to give her a year chip. Isn't that neat? And my niece found out that I was going to come in town through my drunk brother, not her dad, and ask if I'd look her up. My mother had asked my little niece not to come to her house because my little niece had embarrassed the family. She was so cute. I mean, she just did stuff that was wonderful. I mean, she and her hophead boyfriend stole stuff. And they had stolen so much and put it in this apartment, and there was so much stolen stuff in there that the police had to go rent a U-Haul trailer to get it out of there. And the newspaper come took pictures of it.
Oh, God.
And there she was on the front page by a U-Haul trailer. And my mama just threw a fit. So my mama asked this little girl not to come in and out of her house. She heard I was coming, and so she asked if the word would be sent to me that she'd like to see me. And of course I wanted to see her, and finally got a hold of her and went and picked her up. And she weighed, I don't know, 80, 90 pounds, a little skinny thing. She had on two pair of pants so they'd stay on, two pair of Levi's. She was dirty. Her hair was dirty. And I finally found her sitting on a curb with this little kid, just, you know, dirty little wet kid in her lap. And we got her and we took her up my mama's house. And my stepdaughter 12-stepped that little girl. It was so painful for me, I couldn't even stay in there. I had to go outside. My daughter Tracy couldn't stay in there. It was so painful for her. Her and her cousin had been so close all through the years. It was so painful for her, she couldn't hear it. She couldn't listen to it. And Sheila 12-stepped that little niece of mine. And we took her to her first AA meeting that night. My daughter's first AA birthday was my niece's first AA meeting. And my stupid brother, he missed the whole thing. Tanya has been in and out. She got some sobriety and then she lost it. And she got it again and she lost it. A couple of months ago, she went to my brother. He had lost a lot of things due to his drinking. And he was living on a houseboat. And she went out there with her little daughter, who had heard about her granddaddy but never seen him. And she went out, she got on this dock, and she walked out there. And my brother was there with some other people. And he turned and saw her and said, "Well, what do you want?" She said, "Well, we just come to see you, Deborah. Wanted to see who you were. And I just needed to see you. I just needed to tell you that I loved you." He says, "It's kind of late for that, isn't it?" She said, "Yeah, Daddy, I guess it is. You're busy." He said, "Yes, I am." And he turned his back on her. And she left. And this poor guy, you know, he just didn't know how to live, I guess, because he took a gun and killed himself. Never forgiven that girl. Never forgiven me. Just an alcoholic, yucky death, you know. This makes me hate alcoholism. I don't hate my brother. I hate alcoholism. I hate what it does to people. And my little niece is just, you know, she had some sobriety and she lost it during Christmas because of this. He died right before Christmas. Thanks. And it has been so hard. I know that many of you have experienced this. It's just damn tough that you just don't know how to do it. You just don't know how to do it. And this little girl is 30 years old, and she's drunk. She lost her sobriety, and she's just drunk, and she just doesn't know what, she doesn't know how to live, and she keeps calling me, I went back for that, and I swore I would never go in his house, but I went back for that, to support my mama and take care of my mama, and it's just such a mess. I mean, everybody there was drinking. That's the only way they know how to handle that. And I saw myself having to totally disengage myself from my family. And I heard them talking about this guy. I heard them talking about Jimmy. And I thought, I wonder who they're talking about. I don't know him. And I sit in this house that he had bought my little nephew, a $100,000 house, a gorgeous house. He'd give it to him for a wedding present. And Tanya's living across town in a squalor. He didn't give her a nickel. The disease of alcoholism. It's just yucky. And I went out in the backyard and I thought, God, you know, what is this? You know, what is this? And it dawned on me that I hadn't accepted his disease. I hadn't accepted his unforgiveness. I had resigned myself to it. And it was painful when it came to it. It was just. And then I remembered, probably in his way, he did what he could do for me, with what he could do with forgiveness and not forgiveness and all that stuff. When my daddy died, my children were in school. And one of the few words my brother ever said to me is, he came in there, he said, "Bernard, would you like for me to go get your children out of school and tell them?" And I said, "Yeah, please." And he went and got my kids, and he was kind to them. He pulled them out of school and brought them over to my mother's. And I thought, when I was standing out in that backyard, that's probably the only way he knew how to do it. That's the best way he could do it. And I've got to accept that, and I've got to live with it and go on. It's made me think all again about amends. It makes me think about forgiveness. Because as far as I know, he's the only one who hasn't forgiven me in my whole life that I've walked up to and say I was wrong. Isn't that marvelous? It's just marvelous. He's the only one I can think of. That made me, you know, whoa, who have I not forgiven? Who has come to me and I've not forgiven them? Who in my illness and who in my judging? What would happen if you get a phone call at 7 a.m. like that and they're gone? Because that's what happened. 7 a.m. I got this one phone call and it changed a lot of people's lives. And I had to take a look at who's in my life that I have not forgiven. Who do I owe amends to? Who do I need to straighten things out with? What do I need to do with it? Who do I need to make direct amends to today? And what a relief and a joy and a wonder it was, because I can only really think of, truly, in all honesty, one person that I know of that I've harmed, that I probably hadn't really squared away with. And I need to do that. Isn't that glorious? That's the promise of this program, that these things will happen. What it says is, at the conclusion of the discussion of step 9 in the big book, we find some remarkable promises as follows. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Are these extravagant. Couldn't say it. Promises, we think not. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. What a glorious set of promises. The directions for me that helped me get through all of them are one at a time in this book. And I went through there once and I marked off what it says to get these promises. Exactly what do I do? And into action one more time, says the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it says, and I'm just going to scan over this. Number one. Here are some general principles which we find that guide us. One, remind ourselves that we had decided to go to any length for a spiritual experience. Any length. And making amends, any length. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. If we have domestic troubles, we take care of that. I had a few. I don't know about y'all. If we're not sure what he or she knows, should we tell them? Not always, we think. That's why we need to make the list. Perhaps there are some cases when the utmost frankness is demanded. And I love this. It says, this is what I just love. Listen to it now. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Yep. Doesn't that sound wonderful? Hearts are broken. Sweet relationships are dead. Affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. And we had a part in it. We had a part in it. I always wanted to think, well, he's the tornado, not me. We had a part in it. We ought to sit down with the family and frankly analyze the past as we now see it, being very careful not to criticize. Their defects may be glaring, but the chances are that our own actions are partly responsible. So we clean house with the family, asking each morning in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. This probably is my favorite thing in this whole book. When my current husband was trying to decide whether or not he really wanted to marry me, if he really wanted to take a chance on marriage, he was so full of fear. He picked up this book and he started reading one night and he saw the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And that made his decision to propose to me. I love it. Our behavior will convince them more than our words. There are maybe some wrongs which we can never fully right. We don't worry about them if we could honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. There may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if we can. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. As God's people, we stand on our feet and we don't crawl before anyone. What a marvelous thing. What a marvelous way to live. When I found out about making amends and straightening myself up and got the majority of them done, and the wreckage of my past year pretty well has been taken care of, we read the promises about the ninth step. And then one day we were having this, a few of us got off and had a 12-step weekend similar to this, big book study. And I read this and it just absolutely, it was so wonderful that I always try to read it again and again and again. And y'all have heard this a lot of times, but I'm going to read it anyway. Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. That is true only if one is willing to turn the past into good account. We grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. Our past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is almost the only one, my past. This painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problems. We think each family that has been relieved owes something to those who have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it should only be too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. This is my favorite line out of this paragraph. Cling to the thought. The dark past is the greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for others. It is possible to dig up past misdeeds so they can become a blight and a veritable plague and get it out of other people's lives. When I go and I make amends to you, then it's done. And I can bring this up any time now. Forgiveness is, I was told, recall without pain. So I can recall these things, most of them without pain. I'm still grieving my brother, and it's still hard for me to talk about it. It still comes up. And there'll be a time when I can probably talk about this without a whole lot of pain. But I've got to, because it could be the key to life for somebody else. Absolutely. So when I get through with that, I'm at step 10. And step 10 says, promptly now, keep this thing cleaned up. And the instructions on step 10 are in the book. I love them. Step 10, and a lot of it I do almost on a daily basis, not always, because sometimes I'm out on the road. But when you're talking about prayer and meditation and people wonder how to do it, this is one of the things that I always do. It just tells me what to do, line for line for line. My husband and I have a good time with step 10. We have nicknamed it a promptly. You owe me a promptly. And when we do it, instead of having to really do it the right way, I just say, okay, promptly, 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 you know. Promptly, it depends on who you are and what you're talking about. What promptly means, right? Mm-hmm. I learned a lesson about that. I mean, I really want to continue to take personal inventory, and when wrong, promptly admitted it, as step 10 says. And it's a marvelous thing. Step 10 says that we have to set things right as we go along. It's a quickly thing. This is what it says. When we're wrong, we discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. And then listen to what it says. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. When I'm having a bad time, when I'm blah and blue and there ain't nothing right, you know, usually it's somewhere I've got a little thorn in my side. I've said something unkind to somebody or gave somebody a look that I shouldn't have or slammed the door a little bit too loud or, you know what we do. And I don't feel good until I finally go and make someone, whoever that may be, amends to them. Number one, I've always checked out with my sponsor. I've learned how to do that. And she's a nice lady, and she always usually tells me, yeah, you're right, you need to make amends. Let's get it cleaned up. Boy, it feels good. It just feels good to clean it up anymore. I just love to do it. Just good. It feels good. Keeps me all right. Love and tolerance of others is our code. We cease fighting anything or anyone anymore. We feel we've been placed in a position of neutrality. We're safe as long as we keep this cleaned up. Now, this is what I love. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. So yesterday's prayers, yesterday's promptlies don't count for today. If I owe you one day, I just owe it. If I need to clean it up, I just need to clean it up. How can I best serve thee? Thy will be done, not mine. These are thoughts which must go along with me constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line is the proper use of the will. Now, when I first came in, we tried to figure out what was God's will and what was mine, and just told me, you know, just do this. Keep your life cleaned up. Do the 10 steps. Do promptly. I was living in Oklahoma. I haven't told you anything about my stepdaughter, and I want to real quick. When Jim and I got married, he had two kids, a daughter and a son. They lived in California. His daughter had a baby and wasn't married. Boy, did he have a fit. And I shared with him what my father went through and what I went through and the feelings and things and kind of helped him get through that. And I talked with her a lot over the phone. And she had the baby. It was a little boy. And we talked a lot, and I went out to see it, and he went out to see it, and it was, you know. She was acting funny. Phone calls were acting funny. She slurred a lot, and her address changed a lot. And she called one night and said, I'm going to put the boy in a foster home, and I'm going to walk the streets, so I can't live this way anymore. Now, the reason that Sheila wanted to put her little boy into a foster home is that's all she knew. Her mother was an alcoholic. Her mother died a few years ago, drunk. Liver so blowed up she couldn't do anything. Her daddy was an alcoholic and abandoned those kids in Oklahoma, and he scooted out for California, drunk. The kids were taken away from the mama and put in foster home. He finally, at one point, that time, and she left him with those kids, and he put them in a foster home. He took them to his brother's house, and they stayed over there for a while. And then he got sober. And his brother said, come get these kids. So he went and got the kids, and at his sponsor's direction, put them in a foster home. So they were raised in a foster home until they were teenagers. They didn't know. They didn't know anything. She didn't know how not to do foster homes. The only thing she needed is, kid, you put them in foster home. And I said, maybe we can do something different, Sheila. Let me talk to your dad. So we'll call you back. So he was listening to a fifth step. When we got through with the fifth step, we called her, and of course she wasn't there. My husband just threw a fit, and I said, good Lord, if you just made a phone call like that, where would you be? You'd be in a bar, and I bet you that's where she is. So we called her the next day. And we gave her a one-way ticket to come to Oklahoma, where we lived then. And she came. I went and picked Sheila up. And right before I went, I said, Jim, you know, this is one way that we can make amends to this little kid. Somebody helped our kids when we couldn't. Maybe this is a full circle. Maybe we can make amends to your kids by helping these grandkids, this grandbaby. Let's do it. So I went and picked him up at the airport and picked Sheila up. And she got off that plane and had a box with a string around it and a sack. And that was her and this baby's possessions. And we took them home. And she was there for a while. Then she escaped our house, I'll tell you. There's nothing but sobriety around there. And, one Saturday night, we were at the meeting. She went with us a lot because she had to. She didn't have a choice living with us. And she wasn't living with us, but she just showed up this night. And they asked for those people who would like a desire chip. And Sheila got up, got a desire chip. And Sheila has 5.5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. That morning, she woke up and she didn't know where the boy was. And she remembered how many times that she had gotten up and she didn't know where her mother was. For days, her mama didn't come home, and she just didn't want to be that kind of a mother. So she got a desire chip, and she's sober today. She is the absolute cutest thing you've ever seen. Getting married a couple of months to a nice, normal guy. And we were back there in Oklahoma, and it was Mother's Day. And I had to work that day. Well, when I got off, I had expectations. Sheila would be there, Jim would be there, and I bet they had steaks on the grill. A nice little present. And I got home, and he was watching golf. There was nothing on the grill, and Sheila wasn't there. So I went and changed and cleaned up, and I thought, well, how am I going to handle this, you know? And a little bit, Sheila came in, and she handed me a TGNY sack. And it was a blouse in there or something. I don't remember what was in there. And we can't stay very long. We've got to go over to his house because all the kids are doing steaks for his mother. I said, oh. So she left. So I went in and I changed clothes. And I carefully did an Al-Anon thing. I carefully chose my words so I'd be a good Al-Anon. So I went into him and I said, I'm going out for a Mother's Day supper. Would you like to join me? He said, well, I don't want to go out to eat, but I'll take you over to the grocery store. Can you just imagine what I did? How that front door was still on the hinges, I don't know. I roared off from there. And I went over and I thought, well, where am I going to go eat? And I was by myself, just going to do it. Went over to the steakhouse. It was so full, I couldn't. Everybody had taken Mom out to eat. And there wasn't a place for me to park. So I went over to this other little place, and it was full, this little cute little place. It was full. So I thought, well, I'll go to the cafeteria. Here, you know, cafeteria. So I get there, and there's a line, and I wait in the line, and I'm finally about halfway through the line. I have my tray, and these two guys are in front of me, and they've been up playing something out on the field. I don't know what they were doing, and all of a sudden, this huge, giant guy just fell all over me. I mean, just fell all over me. And I was picking him up, and his friend, and we, you know, toted him in and laid him down on the carpet, and I got cold compresses and took care of the guy, and he was just, you know, too hot and been playing too long and dehydrated, and got him all fixed up and took him off. So I go and go back to the line. I said, what'd y'all do with my tray? Well, we threw it out. Yeah. And the line by now, you know, is 10 blocks long. So I told them what they could do with their cafeteria and left. Well, I wound up at this cruddy diner. You know, y'all probably got one. It's just, you just barely get in there and get out. The grease smells so bad. And I'm in there and I look, and at that point I'm trying to get skinny, wonderful. And I quit smoking. I didn't have that to do anymore, and I gained all this weight. Can't get rid of it. So I'm on Weight Watchers, and they didn't have steaks there at all. And I look, and I thought, well, I guess it's time to get my liver and onions. So I order liver and onions for my Mother's Day supper by myself. And I've about two or three bites of it, and here comes a guy that I knew, and he said, well, what are you doing alone on Mother's Day? Well, that was it. I just... And I went home, and I went into my bedroom and shut my door. And I don't remember how long I punished him with silence, but it had to be a pretty good stint, you know, because that was a pretty major offense. So, next year rolls around. Next year, he's out of town speaking somewhere, and he comes in on Sunday afternoon. And he hands me this little sack, and there's a cute little frame in there. And he said, here's your Mother's Day present, and there's a card in there. Now, he never buys me cards. He writes something on the back of a shoebox or something, you know. And he said, here, I wish it could be more. I said, more? Well, let me tell you, this is something. Do you remember last Mother's Day? He said, well, I don't think so. Well, I do. I worked all day. I come in and ask you, and Sheila goes off, and they think that. I go down there. I can't find him. This man falls over me. He falls down and stay there, and then there's no card. I'm crying. I'm going to slam the door, and you didn't even care. And he's standing there, and he's looking at me, and he says, oh. And he just ran and walked out of the kitchen. And when he did, I went, that just felt so good. It only took me a year. And I have to remember that whole year that I was waiting, honey. I was waiting for next Mother's Day. And ain't nothing he could come up with that was going to work. Nothing. I don't care what he'd come up with. It wasn't going to work because I was going to tell him so he would promptly. And he did, and just walked out the kitchen. It was a strange thing. Lesson for me. If you have something to say, say it and get the fight over with. I love this, you know. Instead of having a bunch of little hurts that just go on and on and on, have one big hurt. Get it over with. It's done. I should have got rid of that big hurt that day, talked to him about it, and then I had to look at my part. I had to look at my part. What was my part in that? Sounds like a tornado ripped through my house, didn't it? It sounds like I'm totally blameless, doesn't it? What do you mean, no, Shelley? I had to see, what was my part in that? My part was, I should have said, Jim, I really would like for you, it's Mother's Day, God, I would just really love for you to take me out to eat somewhere. Would you please do that? Instead of that silly little thing I went through, well, I asked him a question and he gave me the answer. He'd rather go to the grocery store and buy something, cook it. My part. So I had to get up out of that stupid chair and go in there and say, hey, yeah, I've been holding that for a year. Maybe that's not quite a promptly. Maybe I'll clean that up. Thanks. You know. And so we got that squared away. There are promptlies, and the AA's 12 and 12 says how many ways to make promptlies. There's the yearly inventory. There's the spot check inventory. There's inventory that you know, take semi-annually, annually, whatever you want to do. I personally do this. I have spent a lot of time in bathrooms. At work, when I'm really miffed, it's a good thing for me to go to the bathroom before I say anything and do a spot check inventory. And the one thing that I have learned that is so great for me is, what is my part here? Not what's their part. What is my part? Do I have a part? What could it be? And Jack says, they may have 97% wrong, and I've got 3. But it's my 3. It's my 3. Boy, I hate that, but it's true. So I have to look at my 3 in those spot check inventories. If it's 3, I have to go back in there and say, for my part in this situation, I was wrong. Will you please forgive me? It gets easier as time goes on. I personally do a yearly inventory. to see where I'm at. And it's just wonderful, because I can go back through those years and see some of the same stuff trailing through there. Some of them I'm ready to do something about, some of them I'm not. Some of them are spoken, some of them are written, some of them are just a quick on the telephone. But it's always get rid of it, because I feel better. And I am at the point now where I really choose to feel better. I just want to. It feels so good. It feels so good to keep my side of the road cleaned up, to do what it's good for me. I just don't want to screw with you anymore, you know? Just, I think that's it. I didn't turn over there. That's it. Thanks. Good morning, everybody. I'm Vinoy Shaw, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. Hi, y'all. Well, this has really been something, hasn't it? Great weekend. And finally, I know Shirley wasn't lying, it's raining. Yeah, it's been fun, and one of the fun things I think about these things is the stuff that goes wrong, like the toilets and the leaks. And you know, I guess I'll tell you now, I didn't want to before, but I really do appreciate the room. I discovered real quick, not to say anything about that, I really appreciate the room that you provided for me. I have carpet, I have heat, I have my own private shower. My toilet flushes. I have a brand spanking new row of toilet paper. I have a toothbrush. Somebody put the toilet paper on the roll wrong. I didn't get to use my shower this morning. No, when they don't know you very well, you know, I mean, yesterday morning, because we had the whole day ahead of us and I was going to do all the work, I had Gretchen brought me a cup of coffee and woke me up with a smile, and about 15-20 minutes later she brought me another cup of coffee with a smile, and I just went to bed last night with all the confidence in the world. I learned there's nothing as useless as a used up speaker. So I had 15 minutes to get up and get dressed and get here. Thanks, Gretchen. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we have become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense. We must go further, and that means more action. Step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. And the 11th step says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. There's that word again, power. In this very room, there's been a lot of power, hasn't there? Yeah, we did some praying and meditating yesterday, and when you're new at it, like I was when I first got here, prayer and meditation was really strange to me. And like my sponsor told me, when you pray, just say, you know, got to at this step and sharing it with my sponsor, and we got to looking at it. I did not know how to do this. I simply did not know how to do it. Seems as if you spiritual giants all got up at 5:30 in the morning, all by yourself, and you pray and meditate, and then you took a run, you know. And I guess you. Oh, that's the worst breakfast I ever saw in my life. Gretchen had granola in this white junk that looked like it had already been eaten all over it, and it should. Man, I like that greasy biscuits and gravy. Y'all's healthy breakfast is awful. We feed that to horses back home. Anyway, I thought you got up real early and did all that healthy stuff, and I just couldn't do that. I just didn't get up in the morning. I mean, I barely got up this morning. I don't do that. And so I thought I was going to be lost. I thought this is one thing that I would never accomplish because I just flat didn't know how to do it, and I didn't get up early. And I talked to my sponsor about it, and once I did get up, I didn't know what to do. I remember one time she said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. Set your alarm for 6:30, and you get up and you pray for me, and I'll pray for you. And you just sit and think about some good things for me, and I'll think about some good things for you. And I said, okay. So I go home, and I go to bed that night, and absolutely, my stomach's in a knot. And I'm laying there thinking, what if I don't wake up? What if she's praying for me, and I ain't praying for her? What if God does something for me and doesn't do something for her? And she might get in trouble or something. I was absolutely sick at my stomach. I woke up nearly hour on the hour all that long, afraid that I'd miss that alarm, and my sponsor would be without God. It'd be my fault. So I did it because I always did what she asked me to, because she would say, did you do so-and-so? And I was scared death someday she'd ask me that, and I'd say no. I didn't know what would happen, but I didn't want to chance it. So that didn't particularly work for me. We stopped it. I think it was supposed to be for, she does things like 21 days. You know, everything's 21 days. Have you done it? Let's do it for 21 days or 30 days or 10 days. She says that it takes 21 days for things to become a part of your life, a habit or whatever. So when she looks at me with an instruction, I think, oh, crap, 21 days. You know? She and my grand sponsor and I were talking about it once, and what they said to me sometimes when you're trying to meditate, which I looked that up in the dictionary. I've really got hooked on a dictionary because when I was in school, I didn't pay attention, and I didn't finish school, so a lot of words I really don't know. I kind of know what they mean, but I really don't know what they mean. So I looked it up, and it really means to think. Meditate means to think and to ponder. And when I think and ponder, sometimes I get in trouble. When I would sit there and I think, okay, I'm supposed to meditate. She said, get your timer and just, you know, put it for 1 minute. And just sit and be still for 1 minute. Well, when I'm doing that, I hear it go tick, 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 tick. And I'm looking at it to say, oh, guys, hurry, and I got to think. You know, it just, none of the little tricks particularly work for me. And then my grand sponsor said that she did it this way. You know, when she'd have a pad and a pencil beside her when she sat down to start this stuff, because she'd think about the groceries that she needed to buy, or going by the laundry or the cleaners. She said when that thought came in her head, she'd just jot it down on this little pad beside her, and then that thought would be gone. Then she could get into what was going on. And I'd ask people, and I'd see them with big books and little books and big books and all this stuff. So I started getting books. I have in my library probably every book that every preacher on television ever sent out. I got little wood crosses from the Holy Land, and I got little leaves, and I got jar juice, and I got anything that you want. And that little ex-husband of mine, his name is on every prayer list in the United States and Jerusalem and everywhere else. I just write off of this stuff. I got oral stuff. I mean, me and Oral, we got to be real good friends. And he'd tell you how to get $100,000 million just praying for it. And just give him a buck, and you'd just be surprised what'd come back. And I just had all those things. It was just driving me crazy. It just driving me crazy. And how was you supposed to pray? And what was you supposed to pray for? Who was you supposed to pray for? How are you supposed to pray it? What was you not supposed to pray for? Things for me, things not for me, things for you, not for you. I mean, it's just been an increasing thing. And I thought I was doing it all wrong, which is just such a kick. You know, you just can't do it wrong, understood. It says thought. That's all it says. It just says thought. And I was doing all that stuff and one time my sponsor said, have you ever read it out of the big book, what it says to do? Oh, the instruction manual. No. So I went home and I looked at this. This is the darndest thing. Listen to this, what it says. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. That tells me what to do at night when I go to bed. Look at my day. Was I resentful, selfish, honest, or afraid? Do I know an apology? Have I kept something to myself that should have been discussed with some other person at once? Here's the directions, sentence by sentence. Do I know an apology? Let's see. Do I think about my day? Did I say something? Did I do something? I owe an apology. That is so simple. Was I kind and loving toward all? Could I have done anything better? Was I thinking about myself most of the time? Was I thinking about what I could pack in a stream of life? But this is what I did. It says, but we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection. For that would diminish what was doing in our usefulness to others. And that's what I began to do. I'd think about the day. Was I selfish? Was I, you know, and I would. I'd think about it, and I'd just get so bogged down, it just really hurt. So I talked to her about it, and she said, well, you're probably doing it the wrong way. Why don't you look at what you've done good today? What nice thing did you do? What one thing did you do for someone else? Well, when you start it that way, and your mind is on, boy, I better have something that I did for somebody today. You start doing something for somebody today. I started with this thing. She said, do one thing for somebody that you don't particularly like every day. So I had this boss. He was a pharmacist and he worked part-time there at the drugstore. And he really was just the smarkiest, hateless thing. Of course, I discovered much later on that he probably had a drinking pill problem. But he was just egotistical and arrogant and hostile and unlike him. So I thought, well, he's the one person that just drives me crazy every day, starting my day off. So I decided I'd do something good for him. I went to the drugstore. Every day this was my procedure. I went to the drugstore, clocked in, and then I went to the fountain and got me a cup of coffee on their time, not mine. So I decided what I would do was bring him a cup of coffee back that morning. So I went and got me a cup of coffee, and I got him a cup of coffee, and just took it up there and put it on the pharmacy and tried to walk out. He just looked at me and looked at it, didn't say a word, not him either, because we barely talked. And the next day, I did the same thing. He looked at it and looked at me, didn't say anything. Third day, I went up there, and he said, thanks. I said, you're welcome, you know, and I just kept on doing that one thing. And boy, at night, I think, well, I got that silly SOB cup of coffee today, and, you know, I kind of started feeling good about it. I did that for, I don't know, a week or a couple weeks or something. And I was feeling really good. And he'd say good morning after a while, and I'd say good morning after a while. One day I didn't take it. And do you know what he did? He hollered at me. Hey, Benoit, where's my coffee? That was a spiritual thing that I was doing, and he was screwing it up. So I stomped back there, and I got him a cup of coffee, and I stomped back up there, and he giggled at me, and I giggled at him. And that started a whole relationship with me and this idiot. And you know, when I went into nursing school, he came to me, and he said, let me write you a letter of recommendation to get you, help you get in school. Is there some books that I have that can help you study? What can I do to help you? Is that something? And I didn't like him. The only thing I did was take him a cup of coffee, so that when I went to bed at night, I'd have something to do. Two other things I've heard along the way that's really made the going to bed at night in my prayer and meditation a really neat thing. There's a guy from New Zealand, just a hell of a guy, he's just accusing me. I listen to him in Texas, and he talks to me in New Zealand land, and it's a trip. And he was telling me about his little son. he was putting his son to bed, and his son, he was trying to tell him his prayers and stuff, and he said, "Wait a minute, Daddy, let's just don't say prayers and go to bed." He said, "Tell me what the happiest thing that happened to you today. What was it? What's your happiest thing?" I thought, what a neat thing. So every night they go in and tell each other the happiest thing. I do that just about on a regular basis. What's the happiest thing that happened to me today? Sometimes it's just the fact that I got to sit down for 5 minutes. You know, it could be one of those days. And some days it's a smile. And some days, you know, it's being here and watching that river. And just, I always stop and think, what's the happiest? And sometimes there's so many packed in there, it's hard to choose. And some I really have to think about it. There was another one, a man named Cease up in Canada told me this, or told a convention this one day. He said a prayer that he's not had the guts to say yet, but it's always on his mind when he goes to bed, and he's looking over his day, is this: God, treat me tomorrow exactly like I treated everybody else today. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? And then it says, after making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and ask him what we can do from here on to correct it. Then listen to what this neat thing says. Upon awakening, I mean, it tells you what to do when you go to bed. Boy, I like that kind of direction. And it tells us what to do when I wake up, because I ain't wrapped too tight some days. It says, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. Isn't that simple? Well, that's meditation, period. I consider my plans for day. Before I begin, I ask God to direct my thinking, to ask me especially to be divorced from self-pity, self-seeking motives, or any dishonesty. In thinking about my day, I may face indecision. I may not be able to determine what course to take. Here I ask God for inspiration and intuitive thought or decision. We relax and we take it easy. Isn't that a nice thing? I mean, get up in the morning and still just back to the end of the day, you know. You sit down and you relax, you take it to me, and you talk to God for a minute. We don't struggle. We're often surprised how the right answers come after we try this for a while. We usually conclude this period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. We ask especially for freedom from self-will and careful to make no request for ourselves only. We may ask for ourselves, however, if others will be helped. As we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or the right direction. Now, I have read these directions 20 years, I guess, almost on a daily basis. Some of, I think, as Sherry and I was talking about, we're just too dumb to memorize things, thank God.